Session number 10252.
Mr. Black, Trial 7, you were just talking about the Hermann Göring.
Yes, the Hermann Göring Panzer Division was a SS division of great reputation. And of course they were quite used to street warfare, having been used in France quite a bit. But here they were particularly vicious in the sense that they realised it was an insurrection, and being basically SS, they had no compunction in taking civilians who were still in houses and driving them in front, men, women, old men and children, and driving them in front of the tanks. Now, the first thing I knew about this was when we looked out from our defended position, and from 500 yards away there was a tank coming down Karolkova Street, which is one of the streets leading onto the west wall of the cemetery. Now, they were, we thought they were people walking with them. We thought, quite know what to imagine. We thought they were perhaps infantry. But then, when we looked through field glasses, and when they got closer, we realised they were civilians, Polish civilians. And we had a tremendous problem. We said, well, what do we do? We can't possibly shoot, can we? Because German infantry were following behind them. That's what we wanted to get at. And we also had one or two Piat, which had been dropped from airlifts, Piat, P-I-A-T, Piat, guns which one could fire effectively against tanks. And we also had Filipinka, these things which, like Molotov cocktails, you put a lot of stuff in, you put either petrol or whatever in bottles, you put some explosive in and you tied them together to make them more effective, six or eight of them, and you threw them you tried to throw them into the tracks of the tanks. But you couldn't do it in open country, of course. It was much more effective in the street-to-street fighting, when you could be behind pieces of masonry and stuff like that and reach through and do it. But this particular, we asked, what should we do? And the Kroll, who was my commanding officer, said, well, we've no choice. We have to shoot. And we did. I'm afraid hit a number of Polish civilians. But when we actually did really get cracking on that, we were able to stop one tank through the method of which I've told you. I wasn't involved in that, it was another unit next to me. And having done so, we got up and found that in a cellar, 50 yards away, there were something like 300 civilians that had been massacred, just shot, men, women and children. So it made everybody concerned, as you can imagine, very much of the mind, that if they had Germans and Germans fell into their hands, and they weren't going to trouble to take them prisoner. They were going to dispatch them straight away. And indeed, a bit later, this is what happened. They attacked later in the day, an hour, 2 hours later, with great force. Don't forget, for 3 days, we've been under tremendous bombardment by planes, by tanks, and by all sorts of field equipment, field guns. Now, they were able to do this because they weren't bothering about civilian casualties or anything else. They were just blasting everything. So it was better for us if we got closer back behind the cemetery and got into a defended position, such a road junction, which we did. So we had to leave the wall. We made three counterattacks, actually, and got a lot of material from the Germans, both guns, Schmeissers and things like this, and heavy machine guns, and ammunition, and also grenades. And this is the thing you should remember, we were very, very short of always. We were always short. Never short of bodies, everybody would have volunteered to help, always short of ammunition. We never had the drops that France had, never ever had the build-up that France had. True, we never could expect it, we didn't, because obviously for geographical reasons, but we had very, very little. And to take on what was something like about three German divisions, with what must have been then about 125,000 people, men under arms, well, under arms. Can one say who had rifles, who not? I know that we were lucky because we'd raided, the day before this had happened, we'd raided an SS store and had uniforms, and we also found ammunition and rifle and Schmeissers in there. So we were walking around in, at that stage, in SS uniforms. And it was quite comical to see them when we got close to Germans sometimes in close fighting, as it was on the West Wall of the Cemetery. When they saw us, they didn't quite know which way to go or what to do about it. They thought we were SS. We'd broken in first, you see, broken through the lines first. But that particular area was also bad for brutality in the sense that they had a general there called Kaminski. Now Kaminski was, the Germans are very fond of taking people from lands they'd overrun and making them into Freiwillige Corps, asking, would they like to fight for Germany? You don't like Russia, do you, sort of thing. Will you fight for us? You don't like Norway, do you? Will you fight for us? You don't want to be part of Britain, do you? Why don't you fight for the St. George's Free Corps? Things like that. And amazingly, they got many people, too. Well, this was rather different in the fact that he was a Ukrainian. And you know, the Ukraine has always been... in fact, one ventures to suggest that if Hitler had played his cards differently and treated Ukrainians and the Azerbaijanis and these people well, then I'm afraid Stalin's victory would have been much harder and Hitler's problem would have been much less. I'm quite sure about that. So most of the Poles that I've spoken to. But they didn't. They did it their own way, and in the event they got some people to join the Free Corps. Kaminski was one, General Kaminski. They gave him a generalship and they, or field officer's rank, and they, he had a division, and his division of Azerbaijanis and the Ukrainians were operating there where I was. And they were worse than the SS. They were worse. They were absolute animals.
In what way? What? In what way specifically?
Well, the way they dealt with people. Those are the people that were responsible for 300 odd casualties in the cellars. I mean, they were, and they raped and pillaged and looted all the time. And any of our soldiers they took, they dispatched them out of hand. They were nothing about. There was nothing to do. So, it was becoming very, very protracted and very, very fierce. On the fifth day, on the early part of the fifth day, we were in the position which was between two certain streets. Not much point giving you the names, I suppose, although I'm looking at my notes here. Obazova Street and Karolkova. These were part of the confluence of roads which came out into the town south of the west wall of the Protestant cemetery in Vola. And we made quite a large strong point there. And we fought the whole of the day with the Germans trying to get their tanks down those three roads, Obazova, Karolkova and Malinarska. And we just drove them off with our heavy machine guns. We had two rocket firers and we had one piece of heavy field equipment. And each time they got halfway down the road, we managed to get stuff in. We managed to get people up into the destroyed houses and actually put Filipinkas in the tracks. It was quite desperate stuff. And I went up on the third occasion must have been after we were fighting some 4 hours. They came down with a determined rush to take this. There were two tanks and there was also infantry infiltrating behind them. After we stopped the first tank, and there was a heavy machine gun position behind, who was raking our defensive position, the person that I told you about, Krull, Lieutenant Krull, who was our commanding officer, was badly wounded. And he asked me there, before we got him away with stretcher bearers, and just remember that in those days we had, the girls were used as stretcher bearers and couriers, and the two girls on our particular front linen with our group was Anna and Zosia. Now Zosia was a very well known person, and she is mentioned in many books that were written afterwards. They took my commanding officer away, Krull, and in so doing he said, well look, you're an Allied officer and I'll leave you, you know the group and you know what we're doing, I'll leave you to take control. So I suppose one can say that for a series of hours, it must be 4 or 5 hours I suppose, I'd been given an honorary Polish commission and I was in charge of the group. But we had a lot of fighting to do still. And as they began to infiltrate, myself and Drem went up, tried to counterattack from the side of destroyed houses and masonry. We succeeded in putting one tank out and dispatched the as the Filipinos went in, the tank caught fire, of course, and we were covered by a heavy machine gun. A Corporal Miesch, who was a chap we left the defending position with, heavy machine gun, to cover us, our fire. As we came out from the masonry and got the tank alight, the tank crew came out of the top, and there was nothing, with their hands up, there was nothing more we could do about that. We couldn't take prisoners, dispatch them, which we did. And as I say, none of us were in a frame of mind really to worry too much about that sort of thing, quite frankly. We knew it would have probably happened to us, but we also remembered very much what had happened the previous days. On our return to the strong position, a mortar round dropped from a completely different position, a large mortar round, exploded about 20 yards away and wounded both Drem and myself. And they managed to get us back to the strong defended point. But it was useless for either of us to try attempt to go on. And the major had come over from the unit of Pinch and said, "Well, look, I'm taking over now, and I know Quill has been wounded." And that was that. We were dispatched to the hospital, the field hospital, and a place called Starovka, old town. We were taken back there. It was quite quiet in the old town then, quite quiet. There was no fighting at all. The only fighting was in Vola, on the western side. This was the sixth day of the rising, seventh day. And while I was there, I was treated, and so was Drem. Afternoon that we were admitted, there was a person came in civilians, and somebody with him, and the general said to me, "Do you know who that is?" And I said, "No, I haven't started out there." And he said, "Well, it's the Commander-in-Chief, General Borkhanovsky." I said, "Oh." And he said, he will surely come to speak to us." And he did. And I'll never forget his words. He said how fantastic it was. He said how marvellous it was to think that there, in all this, he said, and the only part at the moment in which fighting is taking place, that an Englishman is on the barricades defending Warsaw. It was rather something, really. And he said, I hope we shall meet again. Well, in the event, I didn't meet him again because they had better drugs, and all the festering and the stuff that we'd had in, all the brick rubble and everything else, was taking its toll. The wounds festered, and I couldn't. They couldn't do very much without the specific type of drugs. And I think actually that probably Komorowski had given them. I don't know, but he may well have given, I think, a directive that I should be evacuated if it was possible. Anyway, it was arranged that on the eighth day, myself and Drem together both came out of Warsaw via Chernyakov, which was the south. Chernyakov. And
how could you get out if the Germans had encircled it?
Yes, it was quite a business. From Chernyakov stands on the Vistula in the south, and you could still get out into the river after dark, into the river at the side. There were big outflow pipes. One could do this, could go into the sewer pipes, and they were outflow pipes really, and be wrapped up and be taken down and come out into the Vistula, and a small boat could take you down there, and what we did. You've got to remember, this was the early days. It wasn't possible later.
This reminds one of the Polish film Canal.
Canal was talking to you there about the days in the old town. Later on, almost towards the surrender, when they had to fight down in the sewers. I think you'll find that's what Canal was about. I haven't actually seen it, but I've heard about it. That was when they fought back into a very narrow perimeter, and they had to go downwards. So from there we were taken. We needed detention. Were taken to Szczesnachowa. Now Szczesnachowa is, you've probably heard about it, the Pope goes there a lot, and it's the Black Madonna, the seat of the Black Madonna. Jasna Góra, it's the Shining Mountain. And this is where we were taken for the nursing sisters to look after us, which they did. And that, and the fact of hiding us out and anything else they could possibly do, And in the event, after 6 weeks, with General Schley, I went back to the Krakow area, and joining with a lot of old comrades, we started proceeding again on the way in which we started. We were on the red on now. By now, of course, there was traffic coming back from the Eastern Front like nobody's business. It was absolutely flooding back. Of course, this was great stuff. We could blow them all up all over the place. However, coming back with the soldiers, there was so much traffic going on the railroads that coming back was, of course, a lot of Feldschutzturm gendarmerie as well, and SS. And most of the, quite a lot of the corps who'd been fighting very, very seriously on the Russian front and were sort of no sluggards behind the lines infiltration and insurrection. So a lot of our chaps got punished rather badly there. But myself, I was on quite a small, innocuous sort of raid, blowing up a ammunition dump. And after we'd done it, and came back to the rendezvous point, the Gestapo were waiting for us. And I didn't learn till after the war that one of the persons that was on the raid, in fact, was a Volksdeutsch person. He'd been recruited in the time I was away. I didn't know him. And he'd given everything away. So I also learned that he was dispatched, but that didn't stop save us. And just briefly, Janosch escaped, actually.
Who?
Janosch Drem, my friend, he escaped. But I, with four others, were taken. And when I was interrogated this time, there was no possible chance of me making anything else other than what I was, that I was, in fact. There was no question. And they checked my records and they said, ah, yes, well, that's out my neighbour again. Yes, well, you've done it once too many times. Now, you go to Altengratel. Now, Altengratel was a feeder camp to Oswiecim.
This is Auschwitz.
Auschwitz, yes. We were very, very badly beaten up in this particular place, just south of Krakow. And back we went into Monte Lupi, and I thought, well, surely now they're going to do what they started doing in the first place. They just take us out and shoot them. They treated very badly. We had there was no light. We were in underground dungeons, no light or anything, and just a small facility for your toiletry, no place to wash or anything. And once a day, water came through the door. And, oh, at least small step, water came through. Now that was, I was in there for, I don't know, it's difficult, 12, 14 days, I suppose.
Which month was this?
12 or 14 days.
Which month was this?
Oh, we're coming down now to, we're in 44, we're talking about November, 44. And in this context, I should mention perhaps that when one was under severe interrogation of that nature for what was termed criminal activities against the state, the Gestapo categorized people into the various categories, the top category of which was Nacht und Nebel, peculiar term, meaning night and fog, literally, which meant that they gave top priority to the obliteration of such people. And the only place that they could do that conveniently and objectively was in a camp. And they, in fact, all the agents that they took from both the French area of operations and Poland, when they were established, that they had in fact got a person of that calibre, and they went to camps put down in that way.
When you first went to Altengrabau, can you describe the impact it made on you when you first saw it?
I think that the difference in having been a prison war in different camps, and other camps that I've been to in addition, even Montelupi. That was a shaking experience, as I've mentioned earlier and recorded. But I think the knowledge that one was now on the way under the top category to a place like Auchengrabow, which was a feeder camp to Auschwitz, was a very sobering experience indeed. We didn't know a lot about these places at that time, but through not only rumours but actual information from the underground, it was quite clear that that was an extermination camp of the First Water. And I don't think anybody, I went with 17 others, who were in a cattle truck, closed up, and no food or water for 2.5 days or so. Conditions there, of course, could be imagined without me going into great description of them. And we felt then that this was the end of the road. It was the end of the road. It made me think immediately of my few days in Montelupi, where I used to be taken out every morning, and in that context, the 3 weeks I was there under the sentence of death. And I think it made me realise perhaps that I had a jolly good run, but I'd run my course now, and admitted the question of trying to see what one could gain from anything that came up in the circumstances one found oneself in, such as, for instance, if there was a possibility of, always in my mind, because I'd worked that particular system so well in the past, was what is the possibility perhaps of getting out on a working party or some such thing. I didn't know particularly that there were working parties, but I gathered they'd have to do something, and there might be something. However, we got there, we were treated in the same way as I think one will know now from history, or most prisoners are treated. We'd been travelling, as I say, 2.5 days. We were actually filthy dirty and needed a shower. We were taken straight to the shower baths by SS people who, with dogs of course, kept us moving very quickly. I wasn't in too bad shape actually. One or two people were, and as they fell they were savaged by dogs, and we were given definitely no indication that we were going to be treated other than people that were going to be put down in a very short matter of time. We didn't know quite the manner of which execution might come about. But when we got to the showers, and our hair was cut off completely, all the body hair was taken off, everything. And we were told that we were not being tattooed at that stage. We were tattooed in the main camp. Tattooing meaning that the number was put on one's forearm. And we were told that would be done in the main camp, which you will be coming to in the next week or so. Having had all body hair removed and given rough clothing, then went into the camp itself. The camp was similar lines to most camps, but here you had most filthy conditions and a terrible air of deprivation and desolation. Most of the people were either German political prisoners, French agents, both sides, both British and French, Polish agents, the same, some British, most Polish, and quite a number of Russians, and all nationalities that have been politically introverted. I mean, they'd offended against the state in some way or the other, but in a bad way. This was, as I said, really, and the atmosphere gave one the impression, was the end of the road. When I got into a small camp, when I got into the small stockade side of the camp, we were split up into four, actually. And these were obviously in the categories. I don't know what the other categories were quite. They gave us different colours for different things. For instance, if you aggressed against the state and you were homosexual, I think the colour was yellow. If I'm not saying that's why Liberal Party wears yellow, of course, but I'm saying that this is what the situation was. And the red ones, if I recall rightly, were people who'd been convicted of political crime, but were also had some other criminal charge attached to them. We had green. We had green tabs, and we were purely political prisoners, enemies against the state. And as such, we earned the full category of Leute von Nacht und Nebel, people of night and fog. We were in the top category, so we were, I suppose, given what seemed to me to be slightly better conditions. We were in one hutment, of which was about, well, very much worse, of course, than any normal camp. But the Hutment was, we at least had only three to a single bed, in a bunk bed type of bed, and we had one issue of soup per day, mango wurzel soup or something like that, and the usual black bread. What I found out about the chaps in asking around, of course, the major thing was we wanted to know who was there, what information they had, and things like this. I found that asking around, in my group alone, there were 24 people who were all been working in resistance groups of some description or the other, from partisans to organised groups, such as in Poland and in France. There were several British officers, or ex-British officers, and there were several rather high-standing, distinguished people from countries such as Czechoslovakia and France. We were in a compound which we were told that we would be called for when we were to go to the new camp, or the camp down the road, and it was only a matter of a quarter of a mile away, which was Camp A, which was Auschwitz proper, which was Auschwitz. There we would be transferred, but we were told it would be a week or so. In the meantime, they said you can in fact go out to a small woodworking party for 2 hours a day. Otherwise you stand here until you get orders. Now, after the first week, the large loudspeaker, the thing, the tannoy they used to use to address the small lager you were in completely instead of individual speech, told us that we were going to pack up our gear, and the people that were called were going to present themselves at the door, so that they called out the names individually, there were six, and we would be taken to the camp. And one gathered the impression they'd been going to the main camp. One gathered the impression that they were going through records, and that the record system had come along with these records, and as they came along, so that the maturity took place, so they said, right, six here, eight there, off to Camp A down the road. I was very fortunate. I went on to a woodworking party, expecting almost, they called out once a week, and I expecting almost every, I think it was a Tuesday, if I remember rightly, for some reason. Germans are very thorough in these things. They always had days for different things. And the Appell came every Tuesday, and I was expecting, but it didn't come. And I got on quite well with two Polish Volksdeutsch people who were working in the hospital there as orderlies, and I began to find that this time the news for everybody on the German side was increasingly bad, and there was little doubt that what the outcome was finally going to be. So apart from the depressive atmosphere which I've described, there was also an atmosphere of fear among the inmates of the general staff on these places. I wouldn't say that went up to the top, to the senior SS members, but certainly middle range and lower range staff were looking for an escape hatch, looking for